discipline?
First of all, it gives a dictionary definition of discipline. And here, there are a variety of definitions. Testing. Alright, it doesn't matter. It's nothing we want. The definitions of discipline. The treatment suited to a discipline or learner. The treatment suited to a discipline or learner. Education. Development of the faculties by instruction and exercise. A system of rules or methods of practice, as of a church. The studies collectively embraced in a course of learning. That's one. Then another one is training in accordance to established rules. Accustomed to systematic and regular action and drill. Accustoming, that is, accustoming someone to systematic and regular action or drill. This is the second. Then the third, systematic training to or subjection to authority, especially the training of mental, moral, and physical powers by instruction and exercise, or to train to obedience or subjection. Now, the first two of those definitions this book accepts as our definitions. One, a body of knowledge that needs, which is presented in an organized fashion. Number two, training people to follow rules or systematic action. That is also acceptable. The third, they reject, that is, subjection, training to subject to authority, training to be obedient, training, another one that they rejected was a system of punishment. They reject those as not appropriate for our philosophy. They say that these latter ones are an authoritarian kind of discipline. And we are attempting to develop a democratic kind of discipline. And these are all rather platitudinous, but I think that if you stop and think, we're there at the bottom of our thinking of discipline. A, we want a discipline that recognizes the inherent dignity and rights of every human being, rather than discipline attained through humiliation of the disciplined. B, we want a discipline based on devotion to humanitarian principles and ideals. In a democratic society, loyal to the principles of freedom, justice, and equality for all, rather than disciplines based on a narrower, more egotistic affiliation of any group is essential. C, we want self-direction, self-discipline, rather than unquestioned obedience to a leader. D, we want discipline based on understanding of the goal in view, rather than discipline based on taking someone else's word for a specific appropriate behavior. Now, the new parents, as well as the new teachers at the turn of this century, tried to attain these ends and overturn the authoritarian approach of centuries. As far as the practice is concerned, here are certain principles that guide the practice of teachers. A, faith and dignity of every human being, positive ways of guidance, understanding of the individual. B, confidence in the capacity of all to learn cooperation and respect. Provide a climate for respect in the classroom, understanding and communication between individuals. C, the right of individuals to have voice in plans and policies, to help students understand why, self-government. Then another principle, trust in rational approach to human problems. And all of these things are very much a part of our philosophy. I think, as I say, I think we pretty much take them for granted. And these are basic principles in a classroom. Now, what does this mean? Lead to? And I'm going through this quite rapidly. If you want to go back to any of the things later, I'd hope to have an outline duplicated for you, but unfortunately I didn't. The teacher's role, and there are two roles there. One, to understand individuals, and second, to be leader of groups. understanding individuals, the whole modern psychology has developed a whole body of material which helps us to understand the individual child. Not all of it is getting over to teachers properly, not all of it has been digested properly, but it is there and it is important, and this is an important part of the teacher's role. The second one, which is less well understood, is the teacher as a leader of groups. We do not have an adequate understanding of the psychology of groups and the analysis of group behavior that we should have. And yet, this is terribly important because we're always dealing with groups. We're never dealing, education is never a matter of just simply the individual. If we deal with the individual, we've taken them out of the group. And that is a factor right there to begin with. So that these are the two definitions of the teacher's role. And then the next point is what are the main headaches as far as discipline are concerned. The first one is the individual or the group. You know that the individual has certain needs. You know that the individual has certain problems. You know that there are certain things that you need from the group as a whole. And sometimes these two come into conflict, and you have a problem there. Secondly, managerial manipulation or attitude change. Now that's, that means trying to manipulate the group to have good behavior by certain tricks and techniques and rather superficial procedures, or trying to change basic attitudes. And this is a problem, a headache for teachers. Then they say there are three types of discipline cases. The first type they call case history produced. This is a type of problem that you would have if the child were not in a group. This is a child who has certain inner needs and anxieties and fears and so on that no matter what the group is doing, this is the case. The second type is group condition problems. That is a problem that arises because a group of children are together. And then you have a mixture of the two with a different emphasis, maybe more emphasis on the group or on the individual. But there are three types of discipline cases. Then it goes on to analyze the most what most frequently goes wrong in school groups, and this is very interesting because I think that just like an automobile, when it breaks down, you first look at the ignition system, and then you look at the carburetor, and so on and so forth. The first point that they make is if discipline goes wrong, dissatisfactions in the work process. And here are a list of the things. Subject matter too easy. Too much of the workability of the student remains unchallenged and has to search for other outlets. Subject matter too difficult. The emotion of frustration accompanies great stretches of the work. Research has proved beyond doubt that exposure to the frustration of not being able to do things well will produce tremendous aggression or restlessness in normal children. Then the third point is language of teachers too remote from the child's developmental level. The next is load of assignments too heavy. Next one is load of assignments too light. Assignments badly planned, poorly explained, or unfairly judged. And then you get resentment behavior. Type of work of presentation too advanced. It's not clicking with the developmental needs of the children. Type of work and presentation too infantile. Activities too much on a merely verbal level. Work badly scheduled in a sequence. Those are a whole series of things that might go wrong as far as the work itself is concerned. Then the next thing is emotional unrest in interpersonal relations that may cause discipline problems. Individual friendships and tensions. Strong, sudden friendship among youngsters sometimes creates stubbornness or resentment against the teacher who seems as an intruder, bringing criticism or blame. The second point is cliques and group forming are often the backbone of group life, the greatest pillars to learning morale. Sometimes, though, they may confuse the school picture no end. The third one is disorganization in group rules. Every teacher knows what group rules are, although the term may not be familiar. Almost any classroom has one or the other such typical functions as leader, second in command, organizer, janitorial assistant, teacher's pet, model boy, black sheep, scapegoat, bully, isolate, rejectee, group executioner, attorney at law, defender of the innocent, group clowns, hero in battle, fifth columnist, a seducer and ringleader, trouble starter, rabble rouser, appeaser, humorous rescuer of tense situations. Whenever any one of these roles is badly filled or not needed, although a lot of individuals strive to establish themselves in such roles, or when many youngsters fight for the same group role, you are likely to have a rise in your discipline problem, no matter how nice these youngsters are or how smart you yourself may be. Pupil-teacher friction is another one. Then the third kind of problem is disturbance in group climate. The punitive climate is one of the most frequent distortions of climate in classrooms. A punitive climate is not identical with a case of punishment. On the contrary, wise punishment usually does not at all imply a punitive attitude by the teacher toward the child. On the other hand, in the thoroughly punitive climate, the pressure on children is often so continuous that the teacher need make only sparse use of actual punishment. However, the punitive climate is perhaps the most destructive of group morale and discipline. It invariably produces those characteristic side effects. The teacher shows little respect for the persons in his room, being so sure that they can be managed by threat and fear. The pupils usually expect absolute acceptance or rejection according to their adoption of the teacher's behavior code. They usually fall into two groups. Some rebel, hate, and fight back. Others identify themselves with the teacher out of fear and therefore have to become moral hypocrites in their attitude toward the other children, so on and so forth. The emotional blackmail climate is another distortion of helpful group living. It is a variation of the punitive climate, but in a different disguise. In the emotional blackmail climate, the teacher, quote, loves all children, says so at the rate of 3 times a minute. At the same time, she rubs it in about how nice and unaggressive she is, how she will never punish anybody for doing wrong, while she drips with enjoyment of the self-induced guilt feelings. In the emotional blackmail climate, you do not get punished if you do wrong, but you know you have to feel like a heel for 3 weeks afterwards. The hostile competition climate. The hostile competition climate is a distortion of an otherwise wholesome phenomenon in our society. And in the book Culture Against Man, there's some terrific descriptions of this particular kind of thing. I read some of them in a staff meeting last year, where it's a combination of this emotional blackmail where the teacher just loves everybody, but where at the same time, because the teacher does not maintain a structure, the children are tearing each other apart in this beautiful, nice atmosphere. Normally, a good deal of competitiveness is unavoidable and even liked by children growing in a society where there's little doubt of the presence of competitiveness. However, there are two things that can go wrong with a normal competitive climate. One is that there may be more competitiveness than children need or can stand without developing negative character traits or defeatism. The other is that competitiveness may deteriorate into hatefulness. The hostile competition climate may be characterized thus. Everybody is whipped into aggressively competing with everybody else all of the time. Reward is given to him who proudly tramples under his feet anyone who dares to compete with him. Shame falls upon the head of the child who would rather get a lower grade than feel holier than thou toward his best pal, so on and so forth. The group pride climate has a very wholesome counterpart. What we mean here is the distortion where group leaders try to develop a strong emotional relationship in every member toward the total group and then over-fosters a feeling of vanity and conceit related to the group. good teams sometimes allow their team spirit to disintegrate into this climate. Well, so much for that. Then the next thing is mistakes in organization and group leadership. Too much autocratic, these are organizational mistakes, too much autocratic pressure, especially at ages where gradual emancipation for adult leadership is natural and an important trend. Too little security given by the adult leader, leaving the children constantly exposed to the strain of self-responsibility and moral guilt. Tossing all responsibilities over to the group with little reference to the children's developmental needs or emotional maturity is often mistaken for self-government and education for democracy, which it certainly is not. Too high or too low a standard for group behavior, too much organization, too little organization. Group organization out of focus with age, developmental maturity, special type of background. Then their whole group of personal mistakes, lack of tact, indulgence in personal sensitivities and allergies, superimposing one's own personal behavior code to the children regardless of whether it fits, for example, tremendous sensitivity to language with pre-adolescents from a low protection area, or extreme touchiness about personal vanity with children who have little school-mindedness or adult security at home, overreaction to dignity violations, plan for revenge instead of educational change to show them or give them what they have coming, inconsistency in promise and threats, stupidity in carrying out promises or threats, wrong use of punishment and reward, wrong argument about educational techniques, mistake in emotional distance and proximity. Well, these are all, then the next point of problems, the composition of the group. Problem of grouping has never been satisfactorily discussed, to say nothing of solved. And it goes on to talk about groups and what may be wrong with the group. This is very hastily, I think, to remind us that many aspects of discipline, and I think in presenting the whole question to parents, I think that something of this needs to be given to show that the discipline is not a very simple matter. And I'd like to make some remarks about our own situation and probably define a couple of problems. I think that by and large, we are achieving our goal of self-discipline. I think that when we follow the records of our graduates going into other schools, adjusting themselves to new situations, from the most formal kinds of schools to the most informal kind, that our youngsters do very well, and I think that the self-discipline that they have from here is important for that. We've always consciously aimed for a situation in our school where creativity is possible, and I think that creativity and order, creativity and discipline creativity and responsibility that we've tried to balance these things with each other. And I know that just this morning, visitors coming into the school, rather sensitive people, they're struck by the feeling tone of the school. That there is a feeling of freedom, and yet children seem to be going about and knowing what it's all about, and going after important goals. Now, we have problems, there's no question about it. But I think that before we start flagellating ourselves with those problems, I think that this is something we need to recognize. And I think that the march the other Saturday was a good example of the inner discipline that our kids have. And it illustrated, I think, sort of a high point in what we are doing. In the sense, first of all, that, and I think that this isn't made sharply enough in this pamphlet, that good discipline depends on the fact that youngsters are motivated by tremendously important goals in learning. They can't be motivated by fear, by desire for grades. They have to be motivated in the kind of situation we want by a desire for learning, motivated by the highest democratic principles. And we set up the Student Council as deliberately as part of a problem of creating the kind of discipline we wanted in our school. And this, I think, was an illustration of that at its height, because these youngsters accepted, not verbally, not because it was a good thing to do, to get good grades or to get in the good graces of a teacher, but they accepted out of the depth of their feeling the goal of this particular drive. They worked in an extremely disciplined way, without the need of any adult direction beyond the most minimal thing. There were many times when they disagreed with adults. They're really very tactful about it too. When I suggested some of the posters to Jenny, she was very tactful to me about it, but she let me know that she thought there were others that were better. In other words, they weren't just following us. They had their own ideas, and they on occasion they expressed them. Yet at the same time, there was a common acceptance of common goals, and I think that this was an ideal expression. And this went right on through the school, from the oldest to the youngest grades. I think that this is one of the high spots. It may sort of illustrate a point we want to make, but it isn't the day-to-day grind of a school situation. And I'd like to get to some of to that now, because work in school is not always so exciting, so dramatic, so satisfying. It involves restraining our impulses, holding back our desires, and for certain important objectives. And it involves a certain amount of self-restraint that wasn't present in this particular situation. So that this was not a typical situation, although, as I said, I think it did illustrate a very fine self-discipline in the youngsters. Now, with regard to work, I think that we need to know that we have specific problems in our culture, and I think that the problems we have in discipline, and we do have them in the school, there's no question about it. I think that one of the things they stem from is the cultural situation. Children to a very great and new degree in our society abhor responsibility. They're careless about material. They have to be followed through carefully about homework. It doesn't come in. They'll do a minimal amount of effort. And you say, well, it hasn't this always been true? I think that it's true to a greater degree now. And I think that there are a number of reasons for this. First of all, the lack of ability of a child in our society to identify with adult work. And there's all a difference in the world between New York City and a small town or a country community, because that is not yet true there. It will be true. The smaller places are going to be having these problems more and more as their society becomes more anonymous, more highly organized, and so on and so forth. But the children do not identify with adult work. They do not, they even do not know what their parents do. There's a lack of clarity about roles in the family, who does what, and so on and so forth. There's an atmosphere in our society of with all the wonders that our society has brought us, yet it's also brought us an insecurity, feeling that everything is impermanent, and I think this permeates children. Another thing that is very important is the fact that children are the first victims of the psychology of our consumer culture, because they're the most vulnerable to the pressures of advertising and so on. And we're doing everything to break down their inhibitions. We're doing everything to create wants in them. And this is true, of course, more of a middle class child, where there are children who have everything. The radio is constantly banging at them. In the old society, they went to church in the Sundays, and there was a sort of a virtue in saving. Of course, the Christian ethics is full of this, of hard work and saving things and so on and so forth. But who is preaching at these children all the time, and what are they preaching? They're preaching consume, consume, consume. And so that this is what our culture is doing to our children. Then on top of this, there is a permissiveness that exists for a complexity of reasons, not just one reason, but for a variety of reasons. First of all, the modern parent doesn't believe in the life with father type of family, and they know they at least feel in some way the breakup of the old Victorian certainties and disciplines and codes, and so they don't want that for their children. They have a feeling somehow that to restrain them is doing something that's psychologically wrong. And because there is less opportunity for the family to exercise responsibility. It isn't your child, it's your camp counselor's child, it's your teacher's child, it's this and it's that, and you the father comes in late at night tired, and there's very little family control, and what there is confused. I think, I don't know, I'm running away with myself as I describe these things, that we live in a terrible world. But anyway, this is sort of an illustration of the kind of situation which is being created by our society. And I think that we're all a part of this picture. One of the things that let's go on to the parent a little bit. I think it means, of course, that children come to school with their particular lack of feeling for controls and disciplines, and then And this is, I don't want to generalize on this because it's not true of all parents. And what I'm saying, all of this isn't true to the same degree of everybody. But it is true to some degree of many people that parents are confused about discipline. They want a democratic discipline. They cannot go back to the old type of home situation, and they don't know just where to go. There is no general code of behavior as there was in the past. We didn't all live up to it, but we knew there was a code. And the parent, like the teacher, is thinking of the individual child, considering the individual child, and not sure just what should be a standard of behavior for all children. The parent also has a different relationship with the child. And here again, there's a great deal of confusion. The parent often becomes over-permissive, discusses things with children which should only be discussed with adults, comes into the school situation not as an adult to come to talk to adults, but rather as an attorney for their child. There's some interesting illustrations of this. A little boy in the fifth grade who says very seriously in the lunchroom, "I talked to my mother about these blue slips and she doesn't like it." Or the class meeting where we were talking about highly confidential things among the parents, and during the course of the meeting one parent said, "Well, tomorrow morning the children will all know about this." There was just an assumption that the children would know about it. There were some parents who were horrified at that, but I think that there were a number of parents there, I'm afraid, that really felt that this is just what you do. You talk these things over with your child. So that this is part of the discipline picture. Now I'd like to get to the school. And what I'm saying now is a sort of a hypothesis that grows out of our attempts on the fourth floor here to change the situation as far as discipline is concerned. And what I'm saying now isn't necessarily everything that I'm going to say at the parent meeting, because I don't believe that tomorrow we should tell all of our parents of children. But anyway, I think that this is what we found in the situation. I think we found, as we examined ourselves and started to proceed to change certain situations, that we hadn't coped with this problem which this book mentions, of the problem of the individual and the group. The problem of looking at the individual child and looking at the group. They mention that several times here. I'd like to just quote what they say. Well, they discuss it several times along here that the fact that we have to have both of these aspects in mind, and they talk about it in this way. They say most of the time we are really after both purposes, The manipulation of surface behavior, that's one, that's the group. And the other is the influence on basic attitudes. We are trying to get a certain common denominator of behavior in the whole class. That's one of our goals. And the other goal is that we are trying to change the basic attitudes of children. And we understand X. We know about the home situation. We know what his psychologist has to say. And we are trying to change that. But at the same time, we are trying to say that for the whole class, there is a standard which we must demand. And one of our problems we found was that often we let that general standard, thinking about it, go by the board because we were concerned with 18, 20, 22 individual problems. And you can't do that.
Again.
I say that we cease to think about that general standard of behavior because we were thinking about 20 different individual children and what each one needed. And we could go nuts on that. Because you cannot do that to the exclusion of the fact that there has to be a general standard.
But you can't work the other way either.
You can't work. Yeah. And they enunciate the general principle there that whatever you do for the class as a whole certainly should not be harmful to the individual child. And certainly that's a good principle to follow. But it was a very interesting situation in the sixth grade where we were looking so hard at certain individual children to the extent that the feeling in some quarters was that they should not be in the school. But when we started looking at the group, our focus went completely on different children. And when we started demanding a certain common denominator of decency and politeness and consideration, that we smoked out a whole mess of a situation that had not been so apparent, that was part of the climate in which these other individuals were living and part of their problem. So that this, and it was a very, very neat illustration of this point, so that we have been quite involved in a whole machinery of bookkeeping where of yellow slips for work that is not done, of blue slip for misbehavior, with Una, the central accountant. And it, believe me, it has made a difference because of the fact that we didn't take this general thing seriously enough for the whole floor and for every class as a whole, and have common standards, many things went by the board. And the children, we were teaching something, and that this book, A Culture Against Man, is wonderful because they're always talking about the noise. The noise is what happens in the classroom that is not teaching. And he says they learn more by the noise sometimes than by the teaching. But the noise was telling the children, and the things that we were not saying, but we were doing, we were teaching them that each teacher expected certain things, and when you were within the orbit of that teacher, there's certain things you had to do, but that as far as the school as a whole, as the floor as a whole is concerned, it was just whether you got caught at it or not. There was no general feeling that the school had a standard that went beyond the radius of a particular teacher. And so not only were we not setting these general demands for a group, but we were also not setting it for the school as a whole. And so that with our feeling for children and with our concern for the individual, you see, we were neglecting one aspect. Now, this, as I say, this is for our discussion here. But I, And this is a hypothesis, and I think we ought to stop now and discuss these things. Yes?
Norman, I'm not sure whether I missed it because I wasn't here when you began or not, but it seems to me that you said that this book rejects certain dictionary definitions of discipline.
Yes.
Do you agree with all of these? Because the one that I'm questioning is the one that says that it is obedience to certain rules.
Training to act in accordance with established rules.
That's one that they reject.
They reject the one subjection to rule, submission to order and control,
well,
a habit of obedience.
What are talking about when we talk about the fifth grade? Does that come? Which one does that really?
Yeah. You see, I think that you cannot just take these and not define them. For instance, I think that there have to be times when children have to subject themselves, or they have to simply submit, period. That's all there is to it. That is not a long-term goal, but that is an immediate need for a situation. If this is the only way we disciplined, then I would say that our results would not be what we want. But there are times when we have to say, you do this simply because I ask you to do it. I've discussed this with the class, and maybe you understand and maybe you don't, but right now you do what I ask you to because I'm the teacher and you're a student, you see. Now that sounds as though it goes in contrary to our principles, but it doesn't. Because, and I think, I'd like to get into that, I think that that is where we differ from romantic Rousseauistic philosophy, which says that you never have to do that, that you can have an atmosphere of freedom, and if children make mistakes, you have to allow them to learn from those mistakes. And this is the Summerhill philosophy, I think, that says that you have to give the child the freedom to do these things, and or else it is not real freedom.
That's Summerhill.
Well, I maybe not. That's why you wouldn't give me your book, so.
Well, I haven't got it here. I'll give you the book.
Yeah. Well, I will disagree with you because I remember distinctly Neil sitting down with youngsters and voting on various rules of behavior. Now, I think that this is unrealistic. I think that just as on the student council, the student council members know that they have a certain amount of freedom as far as this drive is concerned. They also know that it's within the orbit of certain decisions which the adults have to make. And I think that any situation with children has to be that. You determine the area where you say, all right, go ahead, whatever you do is okay. And you really mean it, and you have to mean it. But then there are other areas where you have to say that no, and I think that the rules of behavior and so on is such an area in general. But I, frankly, I'm talking from not having read it for some time. I think
that's
that,
not important.
Yes, and I think that what Neil has, what shines through there, which we want, is a real respect for children. And he will allow that respect to go to the point where he'll let them, do a lot of things. And he really does respect children, which you have to admire in him.
Can I just add one more?
Yes.
In addition, the approach to discipline is we have to make children want to do it. And I think this is something that I search for too, that the rules without getting eventually do I really want to walk through this hall without pushing, hollering, or whatever it is we're objecting to, is the root, really, of the inner discipline that we're going to.
I don't know, maybe I'm too big for you, but I don't believe that you should try and make the child want to do everything.
You mean that we don't try?
Everything for the...
Well, you see,
I think you should try and make it a reasonable approach, a reason why they should do it, something. But not that they have to like it.
Larry, and then you know.
I'm going along with Kathy here. I have a whole list of different things that I've made many observations over the time working with these different children. And there's a very big difference between the seventh and the eighth grades and the fifth and the sixth grades. Now, one of the questions you spoke about democracy in the school. And certainly that's a very good goal, that the children should be made or should learn to understand that there's a good of a group involved and rather than their own selfish motivation. But many of them can't comprehend it or don't want to comprehend it. Why should they comprehend it? Because it involves giving up of themselves. Now, in the sixth grade, very often they're asked to do something. Why should I do it? And this isn't one case, this is five or six cases. I don't want to do it, why should I? And in a case where the group has to move, you can't have six or five or a dozen kids saying why. It's to be done. And if it were in certain cases where you'll say these things can be discussed or these things can be discussed later, but it becomes these problems come up in very picayune situations, not just major situations, small things. Why should we do it? And as I say, I do not reject this democratic approach, because certainly that does encompass the respect of the individual person. But where do you draw the line?
You know?
Well, you see, I don't know if I can talk to a boy about 5 years today. I'm learning a lot in this area, and I think, Lisa, that we don't have to try to argue with the youngster to make him change his mind as to what does he want to walk down the hall. You see, what I'm beginning to find is our strong point is, as I just talked to Bill, you know, do you like learning? Yes. Do you want to stay in the school? Yes. Why? Because there are things here you want. All right, then in order to get those, we have to have an atmosphere, and you have to do this and this and this. And these are things that create the atmosphere that will enable you to learn, which is what you want to do. And this is what I think, you know, Kathy, that mm-hmm. is the incentive and the motivation, and do it because you want to do it. I think that if we argue on do you want to walk down the hall, why we could we're trying to...
Whoever in the whole world said that.
What?
Whoever in the whole world said that. I say maybe by the eighth grade they'll want to. It's what Neil hopes, not I. Maybe I do, but I'm just loving. Since somehow
I think that you can make the
one thing that we hope he'll want to. If he doesn't, we'll say do it because I said so.
I think that you can make most of them understand that in order to have any sort of atmosphere where they can function in the way they want to, that they have to walk down the hall. And I still have to talk to a child who thinks that he wants the chaotic conditions that he is helping to create. They don't want that. They want the learning experience, all the exciting and wonderful things that are going on in the school. But in the meantime, they haven't been able to discipline themselves in these other areas.
Yes.
Three children in the sixth grade were asked to write comp. They took about 5 minutes behind the class. They wanted to fool around on the stairs. And they were asked to write a composition on how should I behave in school? And why? And well, the compositions haven't been turned in yet. They were given ample time. But I discussed this with two of the children and with some of the other children who came to me to talk. And how should they behave? Well, I should sit and be quiet. Why? Because I might be punished. They still do not understand that if they misbehave, it'll be a general chaotic situation.
Well, I think that the important thing about this, and I just think is terribly important, that we are not going to be saved by this machinery that we're talking about. It is tremendously important, but at the same time, we have to always be considering the other side of the picture, who this youngster is, what it is that he needs, what it is that he's saying, and working on that. Now, and I think that all this whole analysis of why discipline breaks down is very important, and we have to look at that constantly. And at the same time that we hold up these standards, we do have to be considering the individual child. It isn't that this is now going to be the solution by itself. It happens that in the sixth grade there's a particularly difficult situation, and it's particularly difficult because all through last year I don't think that we had the diagnosis and we allowed the situation to crystallize into a pattern. And now it's hard to break that pattern, and it's taking a while, but I think that this dual approach we must always have. We mustn't do one or the other alone. Yes, Francis?
I think the biggest problem in the child's mind is this line, where the line should be drawn between being an individual and complying to certain rules that are necessary in a situation such as a school or in any other situation, and also bringing into this respect for the teacher and respect for the situation in which the child is in. And there are many children who feel that they won't comply with certain rules because they want to be an individual. I think there's a misunderstanding there in the child's mind, and I think that many of these situations could be solved, particularly in the seventh and eighth grade, and perhaps in the sixth, with children, if they could understand or be made to understand or shown the difference, where it stops the line of respect and the line of following certain rules, and where they can be an individual. And a mixture of both of those, I think, would be quite a solution.
Margaret, put your hand up.
Well, it sounds to me like all of this might be summarized by saying that we are trying to clarify children's purposes. What are we here for, and all that stuff, and what's the atmosphere in which we can accomplish that best? And I'm still working on the freedoms that Lita has brought up this year and last year several times. And I must say, it seems to be a good word.
Yes, well, certainly it's our philosophy. This is why we get into trouble. If we didn't believe in this matter of self-respect and self-expression, having your own ideas, there wouldn't be any confusion in the children at all. They wouldn't be confused in an extremely authoritarian school. I think that Alva, what you were doing, would be interesting to tell about that with the Bill of Rights.
I'm not sure.
Sonia is what I've been talking to you about. We're studying Britain in Magna Carta. The children are writing a Magna Carta for the sixth grade. And on one side is freedoms and privileges, and the other side is responsibilities and services. And what we're doing now is really sort of a preliminary stage of what are some of the freedoms and privileges you have in the school and in the classroom. And from that, we plan to talk about now, let's put this is just the part in our classroom, now put it on the basis of the whole school, and what are these things. This unit suggested that we make up a chart to put out here in the hallway, a little bright. So this is what we're doing now. It's been very interesting. Like today somebody said, well, does everybody have to agree with everything on there? And I was getting late, so we couldn't get into that too much, but now something's not going to happen.
You can tell them that they don't have to accept all of the freedoms.
No, but the question of how do you get a handle now, this whole question of what majority opinion means, and how you have to, you know, abide by majority. And even though you might, you individually might not agree with this, but it is.
You get majority of one, and you know that whole question.
Sonia and I are sort of discussing it because we both are sort of questioning.
Well, if they can prove that this is an unjust society, then they would have the right to, for civil
liberties. But would they? We would never allow them to go that far.
Sonia said that in every case where they were
because they are children.
Freedom. She said that the children on their own recognize
that. Finally said, you know, every time there's a freedom, there's a responsibility that goes with it. And this came up, and then the discussion of questioning the responsibility,
whether somebody will raise something. And then they get into a discussion of whether that's a responsibility or freedom. And then, you know, you get into that kind. Somebody brought up the question of lying. What was that? And then, you know, getting into a discussion of that.
I was going to say that even with the younger children, you can have wonderful discussions, and very often the most verbal child is the one who's confused about himself and his own role and how he fits in with the group and isn't even conscious of the things that he does that stray from this code of behavior or whatever it is. This is very difficult.
You can talk it beautifully.
I'm sure it's true with the older children.
Larry?
Discussion of freedom in a philosophical term, there's a difference between freedom from, which most children think freedom is, and freedom to, which is what you want them to get. In other words, if you give up something willingly, that's freedom to, and that's just as much freedom as freedom from. And most children believe that freedom is freedom from, and doesn't involve at all freedom to do something.
Well, that's a mature one.
Well, I kind of think that some of these, this whole thing on discipline is tied up to, as you pointed out earlier, Norman, to the culture in which we live and the contradictions within our culture. It seems to me there are two big problems. First off, in our culture, we have a double standard for almost everything. This is universal in our culture, number one. And number two is this is our concept of democracy. And that the concepts of democracy are as varied as the number of people we have in the room. And again, it's sort of tied up to the linguistics approach, semantics approach. Democracy isn't something that which we can really give a, I don't think we can, give a, you know, a definition for, because democracy is something that is in a constant change, This is what democracy is, it seems to me. It seems to me that this thing of double standards in our culture is something we should examine, we're aware of it, but I think sometimes we should really sit down and spell them out. I know I have had to do this in my own personal life, and it's amazing how many double standards we live by without being aware of them. No, I meant really. And I think this is a product of the culture in which we live. And if we could clarify some of these, or spell them out, it seems to me it would help us in our dealing with the children. As you pointed out early, different families have different values of which they live. And these kids come within a setting with all these different values. And here we, in our group living together within a school, we must come up with certain values that are universal to our school, and the attitudes and values of which we hope the kids will, through these, will get some insight to themselves. And I think we have to start this, and I think we do start it, with the right from the nursery school on up. But we are somewhere we have to set up for ourselves, as you're doing on the fourth floor and in the fifth grade, you know, we really have to kind of do this collectively as a unit in the school so that we have this road that we, the framework that Norman mentioned, and then we can deviate to the individual kids and how they fit into and where we can best help the individuals within this roadway.
Eileen?
A lot of the discussion so far has centered around the older children in the upper grades, and something that's been bothering me as a new teacher is how do you get a young child to internalize his controls? How do you get a young child to discipline himself? How can you remove the external discipline, stop sitting on them constantly, and get them to do it for themselves?
Want to do it.
Thank you.
Well, in the fall, I'm wondering why the psychologist's not here in this discussion. In a way, you talked about the approach. In child psychology, that evolution in thinking. I mean, from the beginning of the early days of analysis of child psychology, there's been a border on life and the fear of not giving.
Well, I
most child psychiatrists be a dog applied or a dog discipline.
Well, I don't think that this really is a discussion. Certainly, it would be good if they could be here, but I don't think it's particularly relevant to the psychologist because we're talking about the problems of the teacher in the classroom, We are not talking at this point. We're not focusing on the individual child and the individual child's problems. We're except to the extent of how we reconcile the group discipline with the needs of the individuals. Yes.
Speaking as someone who currently or recently taken the span of the school. Working with the younger children as well as the older children. In the park, there are situations of some children wanting to do certain things with the others, and other children not wanting to do them. And with some teachers, it's a very permissive attitude, and with others, it's a bit more structured. Contradictory situation here, but I think that if you take a look at this younger situation, it begins to reflect on the older situation with the older children. And just where you tell a child, this is time to do this, and we're going to do it. If you don't want to do it, you know, if you want to be crude about it, tough. I'm not saying you tell a child that. But if he can say it in the first or second or third grade, I'm not going to do it, to hell with you. He'll say it in the seventh and the eighth and in high school and in college and on the street.
Yes.
One
thing about the park and little children that I feel sorry about, especially with our city kids, and that's that I think that I am very reluctant to force a kid to do something in that park, which is such precious outdoor time, you know, that he really, truly, for reasons that I may know, or, you know, the kid may know, he doesn't want to do it. This is the only time that he has to be out of doors to do what it is that he wants to do out of doors. It doesn't mean that he can do these things and spoil group activities. It doesn't mean that he must, you know, go along with
Yes.
I think it's something that Mr. Sitzelman said is an aspect of this whole question that we haven't discussed. And that's we put the whole burden on the kids here and how about us. I think there should be no situation where a teacher puts herself in a position where a kid says to her, I want it. And I think that it is destructive of the child himself.
for us to permit a child in any situation to say, no, I won't. Children will, and we have to handle that with strength and with firmness. But I think we have to examine ourselves. And the question that Mr. Ciccarelli raises, if first and second graders say, I won't do it, Mr. Ciccarelli, is for perhaps for us to examine, what is it we're asking of these kids? And Mr. Ciccarelli's answer, of course, should at that point be tough.
No.
I'm a teacher, and I said we are playing or doing this, and a child will do it, or I said, please sit over there and I'll talk to you later, or whichever way it ends, and that's the way it ends there. But how about our then re-exam? Or any teacher of a grade where things falling apart. We are trying to build up these controls, resistances, desires. Frankly, short of taking his math, how are we going to make him keep still? He has got to want to close his mouth and stop the sounds from coming out for whatever reason. We cannot time. We cannot make him not jump in the chair unless we time. And we're not going to time. Basically, we've got to make him want to sit, make himself do it. He is the only one who can. So, perhaps then we have to turn around and say, maybe my park program ought to be reconsidered if kids are saying, I don't want to. Maybe my classroom situation, what is it that I am demanding of him that is too much for him, of the group? We're talking about a group that seems to be too much for this group because it's falling apart on me. Is there something that I can make my goal, say, too big, too small? My